Mr. Sandberg.
Good morning, Your Honors. Craig Sandberg for the plaintiff appellant here. The sole issue in this case is whether or not Ms. Tatata's complaint that was filed in the district court was timely based on the right to sue letter that had been issued from the EEOC. There's a whole host of nuanced factual issues in this case that kind of distinguishes it generally from what the case law is here in the circuit. In March, a right to sue letter had been issued. Ms. Tatata's EEOC complaint that charged the EEOC was pro se on her own behalf.
I just want to clarify that the address on file with the EEOC for communications was Ms. Tatata's, not this other person?
That's correct. You're talking about the South Halsted address?
Right.
That is her residence.
That's her residence. But you're saying to us this is not one of those cases where, say, there's an attorney's address on record and the EEOC thinks, well, we can send it to the lawyer. It was very clear on the paperwork where they should have addressed it to.
Right. If I could answer that, it's a little bit more complicated than that. Her charge is written by her address, the South Halsted. That's her residence. The gentleman, Jewel Bracco, to whom the right to sue letter was sent. And we know, in fact, that that's where it's sent. The record's clear. The EEOC has a copy of that certified letter that was attempted on three different occasions, lastly on the 19th. That certified mail number, the corresponding, is the same number that's at the top of the dismissal, the right to sue notice, even though that has her home address.
So had they sent the envelope, it has her address on the outside of the envelope.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. And also, so that this court is clear, Jewel Bracco's name had been included in an EAS questionnaire as a person who we can contact if we are unable to reach you, similar to any notification that I put my wife's cell and my number for my children's things at school. So if you can't get a hold of her at her home address or at her phone number, you can contact him, and maybe he'll be able to get in contact with her. So the EEOC sends this. It is unreceived by anybody.
But actually what you're saying is that she wasn't saying he's an alternative. He's a backup, and they should have tried her first.
I'm not even saying that he should ever have received notice of the right to sue. He is not her attorney of record. He is simply a person identified in the questionnaire as someone who could be contacted if you're unavailable to contact her. And they made no efforts to contact her with the right to sue letter. What she ends up doing after a period of time has gone by is...
Putting to one side whether the file identifies Bracco as De Tata's agent, as attorney,
right?
Is it agreed that Bracco was De Tata's agent?
He was never her agent. He was someone to whom they...
How is Bracco ever filing anything if not as her agent?
I'm not sure how the correspondence or dialogue that may have occurred between the EEOC...
I'm not asking about the court. I'm asking about what we know about what was going on in the EEOC. I take it that the record shows that the EEOC regularly communicated with Bracco to determine what would happen to De Tata's proceeding.
Okay.
And that De Tata never complained about that. Is there anything else we know from the EEOC file about whether Bracco was acting with De Tata's consent as an agent?
I'm not sure that there's anything formally where Ms. De Tata said, yes, for future correspondence or anything, you can go ahead and talk with him, other than maybe he was communicating things that she might not.
One reason why I'm asking these questions is because your adversary relied on the fact that a letter was sent to Bracco, and your reply brief simply ignored the problem. Didn't talk about whether Bracco was De Tata's agent, didn't talk about the circumstances under which notice to an agent is notice to a principal. Now, we're going to have to consider whether you forfeited any arguments on this score. I don't know why, when an opponent offers an alternative ground for affirmance, and that's what this is. The district court didn't rely on it. The appellees were entitled to urge any available ground in support of affirmance. Why would a lawyer just ignore it in the reply brief?
Well, The reason it wasn't addressed specifically, Your Honor, is that there was nothing there was nothing formally provided by Ms. DeTata that allowed for him to be her formal agent for purposes of receipt of any right to sue letter. The fact that he may have communicated on her behalf, I'm not sure whether or not that's something that
he's in Mississippi,
letter.
Isn't he?
That's correct.
Did she ever have any contact with him? I mean, other than did she ever see him, meet him, talk to him?
Your Honor,
she called him on the phone, I understand.
Right, Your Honor. I'm not sure exactly what the circumstances of her communications with him, and they're certainly not in the record. But as far as the issue of Jewel Bracco, Your Honor.
There is a letter in the EEOC case file from Bracco. It's a copy of a letter to Rollprint. And the letter says that his office has filed with the EEOC a complaint on behalf of DeTata. Now, that certainly is the kind of letter an attorney sends when he's been retained to represent a client.
Right. And that letter,
are you saying that, is that an accurate statement, or is Bracco engaged in the unauthorized practice of law? Is Bracco lying to Rollprint? I mean, this is all very peculiar.
Right, and there was no evidence as to that in the district court, so I can't answer that specifically. What I do know is that that particular letter was directed to Rollprint, so whatever it means, it certainly doesn't change or should not change the behavior of the EEOC. Moreover, there is in the record an indication that in the declaration of Tyrone, the EEOC gentleman, Tyrone Urban, indicating that Mr. Bracco had advised them that he was going to be out of communication until the end of March, should they wish to communicate with him. Yet, apparently, in disregard of that, even, they chose to send the certified mail to that address, where they would have necessarily known that it couldn't have been received within the period of time, and he wouldn't have had notice that it had been received. So, on that particular.
So in general, if I can sort of step back,
sure.
You are saying that because the district court ruled as it did, there are facts about this theory that your opponent is attempting to raise right now that would have to be explored before it could be decided on that basis.
Well certainly, absolutely, that's true. And I think that.
So the record's insufficient as it stands to know one way or the other about any scope of agency that Mr. Bracco may have.
As to Mr. Bracco's conduct, correct. But I think in going a little bit further, and just so I can address it with Your Honors, is the issue of whether or not here in the Seventh Circuit actual receipt of the letter is required versus whether or not a communication from someone at the EEOC that a right to sue letter had been issued.
Why, by the way, is receipt the important time? The statute says the 90 days begins to run from, and I quote, the giving of notice. And that sounds more like the sending of the letter than the receipt of the letter.
Well, and I can certainly understand that, but we're also confronted with what the language of the right to sue letter says, which is that the lawsuit must be filed within 90 days of your receipt of this notice.
During which the lawsuit is filed depends on the language of the statute, not on the language of the letter.
Right.
The EEOC can't extend the time provided by the statute. So why, your opponent seems to have conceded that receipt of notice rather than the giving of notice is what's important. But I just wonder why, in your view, that statute shouldn't be read the same way we view, say, the rule for filing a judgment in the district court. The time to file a notice of appeal begins when the district court's judgment is entered on the docket, not when it's received by a litigant.
Well, in a case like that, for instance, me as an attorney have an obligation to look to that docket of any of my cases to find out what's being done. In this particular case, there is no docket that Sherry DeTata can...
I'm not referring to whether there is a technical thing called a docket. I'm referring to the language of the statute, right? For the time to appeal, the language in Rule 4 is entry. The language in this statute is giving rather than receipt.
Okay.
Those are, one would think, different concepts.
Well,
maybe there's some background understanding in which giving means receipt. There may be some background cases before 64.
The commission interprets it as receipt, or it wouldn't have the language in its letter.
And just so I could address briefly, I know my time is up here, but to answer your question, Your Honor.
You can always answer questions as long as the judges keep asking.
Absolutely, Your Honor. The issue of that you're talking about, the issuance of the letter, there are circumstances where the issuance of the letter that can't be a proper starting point because, for instance, they issue the letter and it doesn't get sent. They issue the letter, it gets lost in the mail. All those are similar circumstances where the fact of its issuance becomes the type of thing that requires you to look to the other facts to equitably toll that time period within which to file the right to sue. This is absolutely not one of those circumstances where the Ms. Detata should be faulted. She didn't leave the district. She didn't change her address but not change it with the EEOC, and so she was unable to get it. And this is a particular case where the defendants in this case are trying to take advantage of the fortuitous circumstances that occurred here in order to preclude her.
Thank you, counsel.
Absolutely. Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Joan Kasheri, and I represent the defendant appellee, Roll Print Packaging Products, Inc., in this case. With regard to the issue of constructive notice, Judge Easterbrook, you asked a lot of questions about that. I think it's important.
I didn't ask any questions about constructive notice.
Well, the issue of notice to the attorney is what I'm referring to Jill Bracco.
It's real notice.
Right.
Right. If you give notice to somebody's agent, that is notice to a principal. It's not constructive anything. It's
all
real
right.
Notice.
Constructive notice to the plaintiff, then, Your Honor. My apologies. But in any event, the declaration that was provided to the district court very clearly states that the EEOC's record showed that Mr. Bracco was, in fact, her representative, and she admitted in open court.
But Mr. Sandberg says the EEOC's file also shows that the notice was to be given to Detata and not to Bracco.
I would disagree that that's of record in this case, Your Honor. I don't believe there's anything in the record, in the complaint, or anything that was submitted in the pleadings that goes to that issue.
But well,
that may disable us from acting on that ground. That sounds like we've now got a factual issue that
has to be hashed out
in the district court.
Go to the issue that I think is really key and the reason I requested oral argument in this case, and that really wasn't addressed by my opponent, and that is that without regard to whether Bracco was her agent, the plaintiff admitted in open court on October 16th of 2009 in connection with oral argument on our motion to dismiss the first complaint that she was aware in April of 2009 that her case had been dismissed.
But here I want to intervene and say that your theory is that oral notice from the EEOC is the same as a certified written notice to sue. And even if it is sometime, I would think that you would need a pretty good record to show what happened in that oral notice. And so just for example, when you get the form right to sue, in big, bold letters, it says you have to file suit within 90 days of receiving this notice. Now, we don't know whether that extremely important fact was communicated in that telephone call. We don't know anything else about the content of that call. So without reaching the question whether oral notice is ever okay, it would seem you'd at least have to have a record to show that it was the equivalent of written notice.
Well, Your Honor, the statute says that the EEOC is to notify the person aggrieved within 90 days after the giving of such notice. A civil action may be brought.
And we don't even know if that was said in the conversation. My point is, I didn't see a lot of law in your briefs about saying that oral was the same as written. The district judge acknowledges that it's an issue, and she says kind of offhand, well, I don't see why oral isn't just as good. But that's the issue that's interesting to me, because I can think of all sorts of reasons why an event of this moment really should be memorialized in writing to make sure everybody's on the same page. Now, usually course, these right-to-sue letters go out. There are lots of them. People get them. 90 days runs. They either file in time or they don't, and life goes on. This case is one where, unfortunately, the system didn't seem to have worked as well. But the oral versus written, I think, is an important question.
And I think especially so when you're talking about such a short limitation of period to file a suit. And ordinarily, a lot of people think you can wait a year or so to file lawsuits. Here, 90 days is a pretty short time.
Your Honor, we did cite two cases from other circuits, Ball versus Abbott and Kerr versus McDonald's. The Kerr case is an 11th Circuit case, fairly recent, 2005, standing for the proposition that oral notice to a complainant or an attorney.
Oral notice of what?
That the case has been dismissed by the EEOC and the EEOC is no longer processing the case.
Is that the only thing that on which notice has to be given? I'm trying to find what's...
The statutory language is just that the case has been dismissed. It doesn't even actually state that the EEOC has to notify.
Well, yes, it does, actually, at least according to your brief on page 7. The EEOC, quote, shall so notify the person aggrieved, that basically that they're done with it, and within 90 days after the giving of such notice, a civil action may be brought against the respondent named in the charge. And you cite section 2000E-5F1. So it sounds like the notice has to communicate the 90 days to bring a civil action, as well as the fact that the charge has been dismissed.
Well, I think if you look at the transcript of the hearing in front of Judge Pallmeyer, she questioned plaintiff in great detail on that issue of what she knew. And on at least five separate occasions, she conceded that she was aware that the case had been dismissed and that a right to sue letter had been issued.
But does she know what it said? I don't remember in that exchange that she ever says, I know that I only have 90 days from some time, you know, maybe from the time of this phone call, maybe from some other time. That's what we're talking about. Does she sue in time? And is the time communicated? You went through that exchange at great length. And Judge Pallmeyer was trying to figure out, you know, was this April? Then suddenly we're hearing about May. We're hearing about all sorts of other times. But it's the content, and you know, you've cited yourself the language of the statute.
Your Honor, I would submit based on the record that the plaintiff's admissions in open court that she was aware that the notice...
Does she ever say, I know I have 90 days?
I don't believe that's
no,
the record.
Doesn't.
But she did, in fact, receive the actual written notice in hand at least 6 weeks before she filed suit, and she took no steps at that point.
But how would she have known that her clock had already been running since sometime in April?
She knew in April that the case was dead.
Well, see, you're assuming the answer to the question you've posed.
The question underlying Judge Wood's question and my concern, too, is what exactly 2000E-5F1 requires. Now, you're relying on decisions of the 6th and 11th Circuits. Did they discuss what it requires? The language of the statute could be read, if you're not being very generous to plaintiffs, to say that the only thing that has to be in this notice is that the Attorney General has decided not to sue and the EEOC is closing its case file. That there doesn't have to be any other information in the notice, and everything beyond that is just gratuitous on the EEOC's part. Now, one, I would like to know whether the case law is in accord with that understanding of the statute or whether the cases say there has to be more information in the notice, such as notification that the time is 90 days.
And I think the bulk of the case law does support that point. However, the cases that we did cite...
If, as you say, the case law supports that point, then you lose, because there's nothing in the statement that DeTata made in the hearing before the district court that said that the EEOC told her that your 90-day clock is now running, that there was a 90-day clock.
Well, I would respectfully disagree, Your Honor. I believe that it was clear, based on her admissions in court and then upon receipt of the actual written notice, that she should have filed her case within the 90 days from the date she learned the case had been dismissed, and that's what Judge Pallmeyer concluded. If there's no further questions, I would ask that the court affirm the ruling of the district court. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.